Welcome to McGuffman. A very special episode today. We are coming to you live.
It's not going to be live. No podcasts are live. That's kind of the definition.
Okay. Well, I guess that kind of ruins this whole sketch. So,
yeah.
Let's just get to it. Live from...
No, we honestly just went over this.
From New York?
Fine.
Okay, well, not... Whatever, just play the theme
not
song.
Not live, not from New York. Hit the music.
It's the MacGuffin Men, with discussions about Chevy Chase, Kristen Wiig, Jason Sudeikis, Adam Sandler, Alec Baldwin, featuring mentions of Maya Rudolph, Sandra Bullock, Chris Parnell, Dan Aykroyd, with musical guest Toad the Wet Sprocket, and now your hosts, Alex and James.
Welcome to the government. If you don't always go out on Saturday nights, you might already know we're talking about Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
I'm Alex. And with me is James.
We're all over the place.
I'm switching up the order, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to become too formulaic like SNL, so...
Snap! Yeah. First burn of memory.
Shots fired, Lauren.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have a lot of negative things to say about SNL throughout this podcast, but overall, I think we're generally fans, or at least enjoy discussing it.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people, they do more talking about SNL than watching it, and they find it more interesting to consider than actually sit through an entire episode.
Yeah, most people are absolutely that way. I am, I suppose.
But I think we're generally fans. I mean, we watch most of them as they come out.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have some negative things to say. Kind of all sketch comedy is very hit or miss, and SNL is clearly no different.
In that it is sketch comedy.
Yeah. And has some great moments and has some very, very lame moments.
Yes. Yeah. And does.
It's kind of something that we've been planning to get to for a while. And now with the new season starting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems timely.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, it's good to have something where we're doing a podcast on something that is still in existence and not like a five-year-old movie that nobody saw. Yeah.
What up, Jesse James?
It's good to make a podcast every once in a while that people fucking listen to.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
I meant like five people, but
okay.
People.
you've done a lot of reading about this. I mean, I think you did some work in post-secondary about...
Yeah, I did. I managed to somehow... the last thing I ever did in university was a 20-minute documentary on the history of Saturday Night Live. Or I suppose video essay. But
yeah,
I'm very interested in the show. Like, I was a television broadcasting student, so I'm interested in live television. And like I've said in a previous podcast, it's pretty much the only live television left.
Yeah.
It's like that in the news, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's, I guess, start at the beginning. How did this show get started? I think we're going to kind of zoom through the history. There's tons of books on SNL that are very interesting.
Yes.
And
that I've read many times.
Yeah. This is probably going to be impossible to do an entire history of this in this podcast unless we made it like a 15-hour podcast.
Yes.
So I don't want to dwell too much on just actual, you know, history of the show.
Yeah, that makes sense.
How did this show even come about?
Well, Johnny Carson was kind of tired of the network playing, NBC playing reruns of The Tonight Show on Saturday and Sunday because Carson wanted those to be able to be used during the middle of the week so that Carson could have more time off.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was, and I mean, they never did great ratings, like repeats on the weekend anyway. So NBC was sort of forced in this position where they had to come up with content. And there were a lot of ideas being thrown around. My favorite being some sort of comedy show hosted by Rich Little.
and what year is this, just for the time frame?
I don't know when preliminary discussions started, but it was probably 73.
Okay.
The show started in 75.
Okay.
If
right.
I'm correct.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's just sort of, Lorne Michaels was somebody who had done some producing for NBC, a couple specials, and he had done some writing and was moderately known, or at least known to the people that it mattered for with this.
Yeah, he was certainly not famous at this point, but known by a lot of people who, you know, work behind the scenes, and they chose him to be the showrunner.
Essentially, yeah. And he sort of got tied in with some people that he was kind of lucky in that he got some people that were good in dealing with the network. And that sort of, he always had some sort of vision. I mean, the show has changed dramatically since it started, but as he was sort of piecing it together with, you know, other people as well, there were people that were confident in Michaels and were able to sort of smooth things over with the network and sort of let Michaels sort of get his way.
Yeah.
Whenever possible.
Yeah, he kind of had some friends a little higher up who knew he'd be good for the show and, you know, kind of defended him and were always friends of the show, as they say.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really was kind of, the spark really was just Johnny Carson wanting more time off during the week. And he was, you know, huge. People still regard him very, very well. And at the time, he was very popular, very successful, got great ratings. And so he just had that kind of pull at NBC and basically said, make this show so I can have more time off. They get Lorne Michaels to run the show. Because around this time, it was the end of the transition where people used to do a lot of TV filming in New York. And this was kind of just the tail end of that. A lot of people had moved out to LA and California. And NBC had this whole building, 30 Rockefeller Center, which, you know, the tree, the Christmas tree every year, SNL, Conan was there for a while. You know, it's a pretty famous studio. They basically, this building just had a bunch of empty studios at this point. So they said, hey, we're going to shoot this show in New York to kind of save us some money because we have this empty building. And, you know, we'll put the writers up on the 17th floor. We'll shoot the whole show on the 8th floor. And that was kind of the beginning of Saturday Night Live.
Yes. Which was called Saturday Night initially.
Yeah, until ABC owned the rights to the title Saturday Night Live. And
because Howard Cosell had a sketch show. And one thing I find funny is that the not ready for primetime players, like the people on SNL, the people on the Howard Cosell Saturday Night Live were called the primetime players.
Yeah.
I always found that kind of funny.
So that show was no longer being aired, so NBC basically bought the title from them.
Yeah. This is like 10 episodes or something in the SNL's run.
Yeah, and so what did what was kind of the show like in the first year?
Well, I mean, they're sort of trying to piece things together. In that it sort of varies from episode to episode, but there's a lot more of a variety show aspect. Like, you'll get a lot more performances from outside of the cast. Chevy Chase kind of dominated the sketches.
Yeah.
Like the first episode, there's like three monologues by George Carlin. I don't know that he's in that many sketches. It's been a while since I've watched it. And the second episode is essentially like a Simon and Garfunkel reunion show with two sketches somewhere in there. And I swear they do like four songs. But
yeah, a lot of the older shows have a lot more performances.
Yeah. And but I mean, you sort of start to get the idea of where they were going in the fourth show. I think the first one that Candace Bergen hosted. And then starting on sort of like their first show back after Christmas with Elliot Gould, when he was the host, that was the show that they ended up submitting for an Emmy. Like, that was the one they were most proud of that year.
Right.
And, you know, from then on, it really sort of was well on its way to becoming what we saw, what we see now. And I mean, there were still, like, you'd still get, you know, Buck Henry hosting with, two different musical acts, like Bill Withers and I forget the woman's name that was. But, you know, just more of a variety show aspect, and they didn't lean on the cast as much. But very, very key elements of the show were always there, like Weekend Update was there from day one, and the host monologue, you know. So they sort of knew what they were doing from, you know, the get-go, but like every show in its first season, things changed.
Yeah, and so. You kind of got to find your voice on the air and see what works and what doesn't.
Yep.
And it's kind of just trial and error. As you said, the guest monologue has been around the whole time, and it almost was a permanent host.
Yes.
Albert Brooks was initially supposed to be the host for every episode.
It was discussed. I don't think he ever really wanted to do it.
Oh, yeah, I guess they'd approached him for it, and he had signed on, but I guess he suggested that it would probably be better if we just had a rotating host.
Yes. Yeah, he did suggest that.
Which is an interesting concept.
Yes.
Because, I mean, we have guest hosts once in a while on, you know, The Daily Show and, you know, even Jimmy Kimmel and stuff like that. It's usually when somebody's sick is the only reason you have a guest host. There are obviously a few exceptions, and sometimes there's a guest host because, you know, you've got the star and you want to really milk it, so why not give him the whole episode?
Yeah.
I mentioned Jimmy Kimmel because when his show started, he famously
had guest co-hosts, which I loved. That week where Snoop Dogg was co-host, it was one of the best weeks of late night television, I'm just certain of it.
Wasted the whole
week. Oh, it was so good. And they're doing, like, after they take away the bar after the first show, the next day they pull out, like, a carton of goat's milk, which is clearly vodka, and just start doing shots of it. It was so funny.
Yeah, but it's just this concept of a guest host. We watching SNL now, it doesn't seem weird because it's been around for, you know, 36 years, 37 yeah. years, but yeah, it's older it really that. Is a weird idea, right?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, and that's the thing. Like, I feel like it would have been less weird at the time than it is now, because you'd still get sort of like the, I don't know, like a Lily Tomlin variety hour, you know, like yeah. these one-off specials. And that's kind of what SNL was. It was just sort of a franchise of these one-off specials, but, you know, the cast and the crew would stay the same every week and just sort of the hosts would rotate. And I mean, they did a lot more reusing of hosts in the early days. Like Steve Martin hosted three times in a season. Buck Henry seemed to host like every four episodes.
Yeah, Buck Henry pulled
those around a lot.
Especially for someone who people barely know, it's like exactly. Buck Henry has 10 hostings. Yeah. Like, what is that?
Hey, he co-wrote The Graduate. He can do what he wants.
Yep. You said they leaned pretty heavy on Chevy Chase for the first season, right?
And
he was their breakout star.
Yeah, and he was the head writer, so, I mean, head writer will always have an opportunity to get themselves on the show more, and he was always close with Lauren from day one. I'm sorry that I'm calling Lauren Michaels Lauren, but it's probably going to happen a lot.
I think it is. I'm not even going to point it out.
I've just, you know, I've read a book where everybody's talking about their experiences on the show, so I just have heard him referred to Lauren so many times that I just, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, and, I mean, also, in the first season, Chevy Chase is obviously the most talented, you know, and he sort of was part of the reason he became a breakout star initially was he was the only person that said his name on the show. And, you know, before Belushi was a common or a well-known name, nobody knew how to spell or say Belushi. And, you know, Chevy Chase would come out on update and be like, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not.
Yeah.
And so from that point, like he within first 10 shows or something, as it started to catch on, Chevy Chase got a cover of New York Magazine, just him. And so, I mean, that sort of made him the center point of the show. And then once he's the center point of the show, to keep this show that's in its infancy, to keep it building and stuff like that, you're going to make him, you know, present as much as possible.
Yeah. So he was very much the star of the first season, by screen time, and many people say just giving the best performances, those things go hand in hand. Who else did we have for the first season? Who are some of those early, not ready for primetime players?
Well, the other people would be Garrett Morris, Lorraine Newman, Jane Curtin, Gilda Radner, John Belushi, and Dan Aykroyd.
Right. Chevy Chase left only into the second, partway through the second season because the first year was so good to him and he managed to get a very decent film career going rather quickly, right?
Yeah, well, did he leave halfway through the second season?
I don't know about halfway, but definitely partway through.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know that he started the show or the season on the cast. Everything I've read was kind of muddy on that. But anyway, he was clearly on his way to stardom, and he was the only performer with a one-year contract, because he never signed a performer contract. I signed a one-year writer contract, whereas all the performers on the show were locked in for 5 years.
Okay.
And since people kept putting the performer contract in front of him, but he always sort of wanted a way out because he said he had never had a job for more than a year, so he just never signed the performer contract.
Right.
So once the first season was up, he was essentially not under contract anymore, so he took off once he... everybody sort of knows the deal with Chevy Chase now. He's kind of a fairly egotistical guy. He's kind of a dick.
Yep.
And, you know, he just wanted more for himself. And, yeah, so he left.
Yep.
Had, you know, a good time to leave, I suppose.
Seems to have worked out. You mentioned that 5 years, most people sign that 5-year contract, particularly in the first 10 years, but SNL does break down pretty well into 5-year segments. And I think a lot of it is that 5-year contract that you said a lot of them signed.
Yeah. I don't know when they stopped doing 5 years, but now I think it's year to year with everybody.
Usually, yeah.
But yes, no, they definitely sort of signed especially the initial cast were on 5 years, or signed for 5 years, like Belushi and Aykroyd left after 4 to do the Blues Brothers. And I mean, Bill Murray was only around for 4. He sort of left with the rest of the crew.
Yeah. He kind of came in to replace Chevy Chase.
More or less. Yeah. Like they needed to replace him. So, or replace Chevy. So Chevy Chase. So they had to bring somebody in. So they brought Bill Murray.
Bill Ghostbusting ass. We've talked about how Chevy Chase got pretty successful from the show. How did SNL do for the first 5 years? If we're just going to stick to that timeline, how was it received and, you know, ratings critically?
It was generally well received. And I think the third year was its best ratings year. But I mean, it was it did pretty well in the ratings pretty much from the get go, from what I could put together. Like people knew this thing was going to be interesting, and once it started people could sort of piece together this was going to be an interesting show, and then more and more people started to watch, and then a lot of people started to watch, and it became like a cultural thing. And you know, the whole idea was that it was sort of a show made by the TV generation. Like this is the first show made by people who grew up watching television.
Yeah, because if this is 75, we're gonna peg the start of TV around, you know, 1950.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got, you know, 25-year-olds who literally have had TV their whole life, pretty much.
And the idea behind SNL, or the most basic idea behind SNL, or at least the comedy aspects, was that it was a vehicle to satirize television and, like, to satirize the medium. And that's why you got all those fake advertisements. You got a lot of, you know, Weekend Update was
fake news.
Yeah.
Fake TV shows.
Well, yeah, Weekend Update for a long time was more of a satire of an actual news show than it was sort of like read a news story, crack a joke.
Right.
And it was like that until probably the 90s somewhere. I forget. I couldn't tell you where it changed, but particularly with Tina Fey and Jimmy Fallon, there was a definite switch.
Yeah.
So it was just sort of a medium to satirize television, and it was kind of a new thing. Like, it was satire about television on television. And, I mean, I'm not going to pass any sort of judgment on it being a revolutionary show, like, because I've read plenty of comments saying it was, like, this is the first time we've seen something like this. And then Lily Tomlin said, well, it's just another variety show. You know, like, I've seen so many of these before SNL. I wouldn't call it revolutionary. And, I mean, since I wasn't, you know, of age to know the show, you know, in that I was negative 11 years old when it started.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard to pass judgment on the show, like any sort of objective viewing of the show you know, anymore.
So we'll get more to kind of how the show's changed over time, but just going off what you just said there, do you think that the way people talk about it as being this kind of countercultural, you know, landmark, do you think that's deserved, or is it just because it was relatively kind of new format, you know, satirizing TV that really hadn't been satirized that heavily before, and just kind of being from the 70s, especially the mid-70s. Do you think that's kind of appropriate the way people look at it now, or is that kind of romanticizing the past after the fact?
Oh, there's so much romanticizing with SNL, but again, since I wasn't there, I really can't say, and I mean, I could guess, but what good is that? You know?
True.
So, I'm certain there's some romantic aspect to it, because these people, I mean, still a number of the people from the original cast are still remembered very fondly. You know, like Dan Aykroyd had a pretty weak movie career, all things considered, especially post like 1988. And, but people still like Dan Aykroyd.
I don't know who those people are, but I understand they exist. I just don't know who.
Dan Aykroyd is so good on SNL, man.
He's such a good actor. Kind of coming down to that 5 year, you know, timeline for the first few. In 1979, we see John Belushi leave.
Yeah, and Aykroyd.
Yeah. I almost called him Jim Belushi. That would have felt terrible. Do you want to talk a bit about the good Belushi?
The
Belushi.
Sure. I mean, like, what do you want to talk about?
Well, kind of like this meteoric rise to fame. I mean, he was kind of known in comedy circles, but wasn't very popular. Mm-hmm. Then by 1979, it was his 30th birthday. It's kind of crazy. He had the number one movie in the country, Animal mm-hmm. House, the number one album in the country with the Blues Brothers Briefcase Full of Blues or whatever it's called, and was on the highest rated show, which was SNL. talk about, like, rags to riches, right?
Yeah.
And he's just one of those people who, you know, it's not just TV, but any, you know, anything that brings you fame, didn't seem to handle it that well.
He had addiction problems, and I mean, being in a position where you can do anything you want, essentially, you know, and be so successful that, you know, and successful and well-known, you know, that you could walk into a bar and someone's like, hey, it's Jim Belushi, here's a gram. Or sorry, John Belushi, and here's a gram.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, if you have addiction problems, then yeah.
You know, yeah, I mean,
it's not going to go over too well for you.
Yeah, the show rocketed a lot of people to stardom. It just seems to be this is kind of the first one that was a big victim of it. I mean, Chevy Chase was a dick, but Chevy Chase was probably a dick before this too.
Yeah, and afterwards.
Just, yeah, the fame just helped, right? Every time we kind of talk about John Belushi or Chris Farley, the other one gets brought up just because of their similarities.
Yeah, and Farley totally idolized Belushi and Aykroyd as well. But Chris Farley would sort of, they would keep, you know, wardrobe was still sort of around from the 70s. And anytime, you know, they'd sort of reuse pants. And anytime Chris Farley could, he'd wear pants that Belushi wore in sketches and stuff like that. Like, I think Bob Odenkirk tells a story that Chris Farley, like, his eyes would just light up when someone handed him a pair of pants that had like Belushi stitched inside them. And he was just such a big, Farley was such a big fan of Belushi and the show in general, that sort of whenever an older member of the show or crew or writer would sort of come back and visit, Farley would just sort of sit at their feet and listen to them talk until they wanted to leave and stuff like that. Like, yeah. And the biggest difference between Belushi and Farley, as far as the drugs thing goes, is that people recognized addiction as a thing. Like, John Belushi died in 1982, which is the year the Betty Ford Clinic opened, you know? Yeah. And it's just sort of like, it wasn't really a well-known thing. Like, and people didn't know that you could die from these things. And, or, well, I suppose they did, but I mean, they never really thought it would kill them. And then, particularly the cast and crew of SNL in the 70s. I mean, it's pretty well known that there were a lot of drugs done there. And, there's a story about when Belushi died, it was sort of, everybody was, they just heard he died. They didn't know how he died. They assumed it was something drug related, but they were all sort of like crossing their fingers and being like, I hope this isn't my drug of choice, you know, that killed him. And they're just sort of freaking out. And, but with Farley, you kind of, by that point, you kind of knew what addiction could do to a person. And, you know, Farley went in, got the show taken away from him a couple of times. Like, Lorne Michaels would send him off the show when things were getting really bad and make him go into rehab. And so, I mean, there was a difference in that people tried to help out Farley far more than people tried to help out Belushi. I mean, Belushi had a couple, I think a year of sobriety before he died, but then there was sort of a movie tanked and he just sort of fell off the wagon essentially before people knew what a wagon was, I guess.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of differences between the two. Obviously, the parallels would be they both died age of 33. They were kind of the bigger, heavier, high-energy guy on SNL.
They were the chubby, agile guy.
Yeah. And they both died of very similar causes.
Yes.
They died of a speedball. Now, kind of slightly different drugs, but a speedball is usually cocaine and heroin, which is interesting to me because it just seems, you know, cocaine's supposed to, you know, jack you up and get you all, you know, fast and energetic, and heroin's known to just slow you down and mellow you out. And it just seems like both of these guys were trying to live two lives at once, you know, kind of the high energy thing, but also the mellow thing. And,
yeah,
you know, working on a fast, you know, high paced collaborative show like SNL, but also trying to be, you know, real people. It just seems like a kind of a contradiction. And I think I find it summed up best with this combination of two drugs that have opposing effects, and they both end up getting killed by the same thing.
Yeah.
And I've never done a speedball. Odds are I never will. But my understanding of it is that the cocaine wears off much more quickly than the heroin. And so the kind of the fun high of it all goes away quickly, and you're kind of just left with the depressing, agitated heroin feeling.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound enjoyable.
No, I mean,
yeah,
you're talking to somebody who hasn't done a lot of drugs in his life. So.
Yeah, and as you said, it's certainly a lot different, even just by the time Farley was around. So do you think we'll ever see someone even close to, like, the next Farley? I mean, we're always going to have a heavier set.
I'm sorry, is Horatio Sands not the next Farley?
No. And I mean, you're absolutely right. In the chain, that does seem like that's, you know, who carried the torch. But are we ever going to... Who was the last SNL member known for partying hard or doing drugs at all?
Well, that's the thing. And Farley especially was sort of the last of it. And it's sort of well known that with like the Tina Fey and Will Ferrell cast that nobody really did drugs. Like people would occasionally smoke weed and that was kind of it. And they went to the gym, you know, like it was just sort of, it was far more people treating it like a job. And it's sort of part of the natural progression of the show and the progression of Lorne Michaels as well. There will be somebody, you know, but who knows if there'll be a superstar or anything like that.
Yeah. And I guess by this point, there's so much clout to the show that Lauren would rather just take someone slightly less talented who's not as volatile and dangerous, right?
Exactly. And, you know, he's 66. He doesn't want to have to deal with another Farley.
Yeah, I would think so.
He's got his own kids now.
Who are doing drugs and need to be helped as well.
I think they're super young, so I hope they're not doing drugs.
I don't think they're that young.
Hmm? I don't know.
I saw a picture of Sophie. She looked old enough.
Okay.
Old enough to do speedballs. So, Sophie, if you're listening...
Don't do speedballs.
Have at it. By the time we got to season 5, there was kind of a bit of trouble. As we've been talking about, the drugs were kind of becoming more prevalent and having more of a negative effect on the show. Lorraine Newman, as you'd said, kind of widely recognized, just was suffering a series of eating disorders and a heroin habit.
Gilda Radner had eating disorders, too. Did they both?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And kind of just spending time in their room alone doing drugs and not really a pleasant environment.
I remember a story about Lorraine Newman would go over to Gilda Radner's house and Gilda Radner would just eat like a huge tub of ice cream and then go to the bathroom and vomit, and Lorraine Newman would snort heroin the whole time. And it's just like they were just practicing their addictions together, and
Whoa. It
just seemed like the weirdest the weirdest hangout session ever.
That's intense.
Yeah.
Yikes. Garrett Morris, who we mentioned, who is black.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess there were some issues with him. He felt that maybe he was being slighted and that he wasn't in a lot of sketches. The sketches he was in, he was only in because he was black, and that the black character he was playing was often a negative stereotype. He kind of got depressed by this and started freebasing cocaine. The story that I read is that they had one pretty racially insensitive bit that black crew members started walking off the set because couldn't tolerate, like, even though they weren't the character, they couldn't see their race be portrayed like this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when he started paying attention to it himself. And but at that point, I think the drugs kind of had a hold on him for the Kirk Douglas episode. Have you heard this story?
It's probable that I have, but
yeah,
feel free to tell it again.
He came out very high, screaming that someone had put an invisible robot on his shoulder. And that
I have not seen
that. Oh, and that he needed people like to help it off. Like, it just seems at the end of this 5-year period, things are winding down and things are falling apart. And it was still very successful as a show, but kind of the behind-the-scenes stuff and the backstage turmoil was really starting to be felt.
Well, and it's the type of thing that'll just totally wear you down, too, because weeks that the show is on, it's just like that's all you can do. There's just so much time dedicated to getting the show going, and it's why there's always arguments about whether or not the format for actually making the show is really good for human life. Especially after 5 years of doing this, and Lorne Michaels has said he was totally burnt out at the end. The reason he wanted to come back for the next season, he just wanted 6 months off to sort of refuel, recast, and all that stuff. But the network wanted him to be back in September, so he was just like, no, I'm not going to do it. In the last sketch of 1980, or I guess of the fifth season, May 20th, or something like that, 1980, they ended with the on-air sign going off. So that was kind of the end of Lorne Michaels' first era, I suppose.
Yeah, it was kind of the end of an era, as I said, like at least for a little while, the start. It kind of does break down nicely into 5-year segments. So What's kind of the next era?
The Gene Dumanian era.
Yes, who's a girl?
Yes, a woman, we could say.
A woman, right.
Shirley Temple didn't stroll in and start running SNL.
But she should have.
Sure.
Well, compared to how this season went down, it might not have been a bad idea.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, she was kind of set up, Dumanian was set up to fail right from the beginning. She wasn't a producer. She was more involved in booking music acts. And the thing was that cast members at that time would say, was like, well, we booked some really cool musical acts. And that was the whole thing. She wasn't a producer. She was sort of more dealt more with booking, and she didn't know comedy. And so, I mean, the people she picked to be in the cast were really poor choices. You know, like, there's a reason you don't know who Charles Rocket is. And
you might.
Well,
he's the bad guy in Dumb and Dumber. That's the only way I was able to recognize his face.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, and it's just sort of, I mean, she did cast Eddie Murphy, but that was sort of under duress, and she never used him before she got fired. So,
right.
So I guess the biggest success of the people she cast was Joe Piscopo. So, I mean, take from that what you will.
Yeah, I mean, season six, her first year, it was very much almost an entirely different show. I mean, still same name, same format, but a lot of the crew, a lot of the writers, a lot of the actors and actresses had left.
Yeah.
And Lorne Michaels was gone, who was one of the architects of the whole vision of the original show.
And essentially did everything, like, as far as, you know, I mean, he didn't write, but he was very much, like, the god of this show. And sort of, like, dictating this will go here, this will go here, this will go here. And from dress to air, he makes all the changes, and then people just sort of do what he says, you know? So he was the boss.
Yeah, and people who like him or don't like him say he was a very hands-on kind of boss who did not want to sit back and just let his show, you know, fall apart. He's very, very hands-on with his opinions.
Yeah.
So season six, to this day, very widely recognized as one of the worst seasons.
Yeah, and I mean, you'll never see it.
Yeah. So let's just say season six, we'll try to ignore that. Yeah. So what happens for season seven? What do they do to try to fix it?
Gene Dumanian got fired after 10 weeks, I think, and Dick Ebersol came in.
Dick Ebersol being?
He sort of helped with the show in the first 5 years. He was a producer, you know, not in Lorne Michaels type, but sort of he dealt a lot with the network. And you might know him now from being a big sports producer. Like, he did produce NBC Sports until very recently. He left. They sort of forced him out.
He's done Olympics and other sports.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, he sort of came in and he made some demands and he wanted to change a lot, you know, but he ended up only being able to do one show because there was a writer's strike.
Yeah.
And then sort of season seven, I don't know. This is where it gets muddy because, you know, I don't know that much about that time because everything skims over it because it doesn't really matter. All that matters is that it was so bad that it was, you know, in danger of being canceled.
Yeah.
That these people were able to keep the show going is very important. And Eddie Murphy. That's the other thing that is important about this time.
And that really is kind of the one plot point when people sum up this era that is pretty much like the most significant thing at the time. Ebersol fired all the actors and actresses except for Joe Piscopo and Eddie Murphy. Mm-hmm. And from 81 to 84 really turned it into the Eddie and Joe show pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, they were the leads and everything. Kind of all the other cast was made to feel, you know, pretty secondary. And it was basically just to highlight these two people. Eddie Murphy's career was doing pretty well, even outside of SNL.
Yeah.
This is when he was blowing up, right?
Oh, he's on his way. Like, the reason somebody was arguing with Gene Dumanian so much to get Eddie Murphy hired was that he had seen a screening of 48 Hours, and it's just like, yeah, this kid's incredible. He was, like, 19 at the time. Like, you need to get him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, by all accounts, Eddie Murphy was an extremely impressive writer and comedian. He'd sort of just walk into a room with a writer and just sort of start free-flowing these ideas, like, with this character. He's already got the voice, and he's just saying things. And basically, the writers would say all he had to do was just type the things out that he was saying.
Yeah.
And then you were the writer of this sketch. And I mean, you can watch his sketches. He was incredible. And, yeah, I don't know why you wouldn't want to use them in every sketch. Like, when you get somebody that talented, it makes sense that you use them as much as possible.
Yeah, I guess Joe Piscopo kind of thought that they were more equals than, I guess, the rest of the world did. Mm.
Eddie Murphy's success went to Joe Piscopo's head is something that I've heard.
Yeah, I love that quote. Mm. Because, as you said, with 48 Hours, one of the seasons that we're discussing this time period here, Nick Nolte was supposed to host. He called in and said he was too hungover from being at Studio 54. And so they said, Eddie, do you want to host instead? And Joe Piscopo felt really slighted by this, I guess, and said, you know, why does he get the chance? And
because he's funny, Joe.
That's kind of the answer I found, too.
Also, Joe Piscopo is crazy. Have you ever read any him talking about a Sinatra impression?
No.
Oh, my God. Like, they would be writing, like, you know that Ebony and Ivory sketch, the Stevie Wonder and Frank Sinatra sketch?
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy is in the sketch initially, like, in the studio on the piano, and the way the sketch was originally written was that Frank was there and then Stevie Wonder arrives. The reason that didn't happen was that Joe Piscopo was like, no, no, no. Frank Sinatra would not wait at a studio for Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder would have to wait for Frank and all this stuff. And, oh my God, every time I read a quote about him talking about Sinatra and the Sinatra family, it just cracks me up. He's insane.
Right on. So we're coming up on kind of the end of this 5-year period, which is a shaky one. Has some highlights. I mean, Eddie Murphy still kind of recognized as one of the best performers and one of the funniest ones, and absolutely launched a multi-decade career from...
Well, yeah, it's still the biggest star to come off of SNL as far as...
Is it?
Grossies.
Oh, as far as money? Yeah. Okay, yeah, I believe that, actually. 1985. Just want to mention Larry David because I get a chance to.
Well, yeah, no, 1985 is an interesting year. It's sort of... Eversole's got one more year and just sort of brings in Billy Crystal, Martin Short, Harry Shearer, Christopher Guest.
Yeah, and these are established people.
Yeah, Billy Crystal was supposed to be a part of the show's premiere. He was supposed to do a bit on the first season, but he ended up getting bumped for time.
Yeah, and then he hosted 2 times before he ever joined the cast.
Okay.
And these are people who had movie careers. So, I mean,
and Harry Shearer was part of the cast in 1979, like the last Lord Michaels year.
Right. But these are people, this was something new for SNL where we're getting people who, this isn't their kind of first time on TV.
Yeah.
These are people who have been in TV and movies before. Let's bring some of their star power to this show and hopefully the ratings come with it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you hear about how Harry Shearer leaves?
I know I've read this.
He quit for creative differences. Mm-hmm. He says, I was creative. They were different. I like that. And 85, Larry David joins. He's only on for 1 year. As you said, they're trying to get some new blood, trying to get something going before Eversole leaves. They ended up using one of Larry David's sketches, and it's the last sketch of this episode, which was where the weaker material is supposed to go.
And which very often now means the more interesting material.
Yeah, but. And we'll get to that too, because I think that's interesting. But he quit and then kind of came back to work a few days later, and it's that Seinfeld episode where George does the same thing.
Yeah, and there were a lot of Seinfeld episodes, apparently, that started off in SNL sketches that got cut.
Yeah, so. Not surprising. Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of the end of the Dumanian / Eversole era.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of season 10.
Yeah.
Martin Short and Christopher Guest want to leave.
Yeah, yeah, Billy Crystal was the only one that wanted to stick around.
The only one that really wanted to stay. But the ratings were good enough. They wanted to continue the show, but only under the stipulation that Lorne Michaels returns.
Yeah, because Eversole didn't want to be on the show anymore.
Yeah, it really was never a good fit for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens for season 11?
He has to cast... Michaels had to cast the whole thing extremely quickly, I think. Billy Crystal didn't end up being a part of it. The idea was sort of bring him on as... host for 10 episodes or something like that. It was something confusing like that. And yeah, Lorne Michaels made some weird casting choices. Like it looked like he wanted to make some younger, hipper choices, you know?
Yeah.
Anthony Michael Hall was on the cast, Robert Downey Jr.
Anthony Michael Hall at like 17 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And post John Hughes fame, which is weird. Like yeah. Breakfast Club was in 85, I think. So 16 Candles would have been before in 84. Damon Wayans was on the show. I don't know. I don't remember any other names. Nora Dunn.
Dennis Miller. John Lovitz. Some of the other established people. Randy Quaid.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Joan Cusack. Mm-hmm. Robert Downey Jr. Our first female black regular performer.
Denitra Vance.
And our first openly gay performer.
Terry Sweeney.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the show's kind of grown up a bit, covering some more of your demographics there.
Yeah, and Sweeney says that when he was hired, he told Lorne Michaels, he was like, look, I'm gay, I'm going to be open about it. And Lorne Michaels was like, yeah, that's fine. You know, and Lorne Michaels showed no sort of, you know, aversion to it and was just like, yeah, do your thing. You know, so. And that was in the mid-80s, I think, is interesting at least.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of Randy Quaid and Joan Cusack and Robert Downey Jr. weren't really known for comedy at this time, though, right?
Well, Robert Downey Jr. wasn't really known.
Yeah, that's true. We know he's very capable of being very funny now, yeah. But that was kind of a gamble trying to get big people.
And Joan Cusack was, she didn't have the career we know now, you know? Like,
yeah.
She had a bit part in 16 Candles, and I mean, she was still very much someone that could logically have been on the show.
Yeah.
And Randy Quaid, I don't know much about. I don't know if Cousin Eddie was in the first Vacation movie or
he
anything.
Was.
Okay. Well, then, you know, then he was more established than, you know, Downey Jr. and Cusack were.
Right.
But yeah, still a very odd selection of people.
Yeah, and how did the season go overall?
Awfully.
Yeah, it was surprising to me. Well, just feels so good to have Lauren back, and then
the show sucks. And it was canceled, essentially. And then I forget whose wife it was, but one of the NBC execs, he sort of went home and told his wife, he's like, yeah, we got to tell Lorne Michaels that the show's canceled tomorrow. And she's like, no, you can't bring Lorne Michaels back for 1 year and then cancel him. You're like, you got to give him a chance to fix this. And
oh, really?
Like, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
So, and then it's just sort of, you got another chance, you know? It's like, well, let's give him another try.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember how season 11 ended? Did you ever see the very end of that one?
No.
It's when...
I haven't seen anything from the 80s.
Okay. So everyone's in the studio, all the actors and crew and stuff, and someone dumps gasoline all over the building and sets it on fire. Mm-hmm. And then they're all kind of huddled in a room. And as kind of the credits roll, you see everyone's name with a question mark at the end. And you're not supposed to know if they're coming back.
Did they actually do that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I heard that was sort of talked about. I didn't know that they actually did it.
Oh, yeah, they did it. And it was supposed to be kind of a spoof on the cliffhanger TV shows. Where it was like kind of
who shot Jair.
Yeah, like tune in next week, that kind of stuff. I guess the very ending, they didn't, most of the crew didn't know this, but they shot a little thing where Lorne Michaels comes and saves just John Lovitz.
Yeah.
And I guess the rest of the crew wasn't the biggest fan of that.
Yeah.
but yeah, as you said, they nearly got canceled for season from season 11. So they came back with season 12 and it was kind of sketchy. Madonna did something in the opening of that season where she kind of read a news report saying that last season was just a dream, a horrible, horrible dream. So it was widely recognized at this time that things weren't going well. So they got some people who were more known for comedy. They got Kevin Nealon, Bill Hartman, Dana Carvey. So, you know,
people,
funny people.
Yeah.
Weird, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so things kind of, start getting going. Things are pretty good for season 12. Season 13, we get a writer's strike.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't be the last one to affect SNL either. Mm-hmm. Gilda Radner, interestingly, was supposed to host that season, and it was mostly canceled, so she didn't get a chance to. And she actually died the next year, so she was never able to come back because she died of ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like Gilda Radner?
Yeah. No, she was certainly enjoyable and super adorable.
Yeah.
She is easily, like, far and away the most well-remembered cast or crew member on the show.
As far as an actual good human being?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
As, people really like Dan Aykroyd that worked with, like, Dan Aykroyd would really sell a writer's sketch, and, like, a new writer, he'd really, at read-through, he'd give it his all, you know, whereas a lot of performers wouldn't. He'd sort of see someone that was struggling and be like, here, let's write something together, and Gilda Radner was very much the same way, but nobody ever had problems with Gilda Radner. Like, I 600 page oral history, like nobody says anything negative about her. It's incredible, and they spend a lot of time talking about her. It seems like by all accounts she was extremely lovable and extremely nice person, and she was funny. She was very funny as a sketch comedian, so you know, I don't think
go Gilda.
Yeah, no, she was good at her job.
Right on. For 15th season, interesting story where Andrew Dice Clay hosted. Do you know this story?
Yeah. Nora Dunn walked off.
Musical guest was supposed to be Sinead O'Connor.
Okay.
And then she walked off.
Okay.
And then Nora Dunn saw this and said, yeah, Andrew Dice Clay, you have said what I feel to be some horrible things about women. And it was her protest, right?
Yep.
Yeah. It just seemed funny to me, Sinead O'Connor. Knowing what we know about her later SNL appearances, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
And again, it seems weird. After another 5 year little piece of SNL, season 16 again is a really transitional year. Basically, Lorne Michaels later described it as just adding a cast to a cast here to add. He hired a bunch more people. Who else? Who came from that year? Season 16.
Farley, Chris Rock, Adam Sandler, David Spade probably would have come in at that time.
Yep.
And those are the four main guys. I don't know who else came in at that time. If there was anybody else?
Yeah, Rob Schneider.
Damn. Wow.
Julie Sweeney, as we discussed.
Yeah.
Who is indeed a person.
Yeah, cool.
Tim Meadows.
Yes.
And you said Adam Sandler, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard somewhere that Lorne Michaels said Adam Sandler was the first person he didn't find funny.
Yeah.
Did you tell me that?
I don't think I did tell you that, okay. But I feel like I've read that somewhere. And that doesn't surprise me. To be totally honest, like, I mean, and Adam Sandler splits people generally.
Yeah.
Like, I don't find Adam Sandler funny, but I think it's sort of that some people recognize that a lot of people would like Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
So.
And I mean, he had comedy albums that did really well. And
okay.
Yeah. Before that, he was coming up. Season 18, kind of in the meantime between those.
What year are we at, Ron? Like, this is early 90s?
18 would be 93.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
I'm bad at math.
It's okay. At this point, we've seen the success of Wayne's World.
Yeah, yeah. True.
One of the first, and I mean, to this date, the most successful SNL movie. Mm-hmm. So Lorne Michaels kind of starts focusing attention on making movies and treating
it. Which is kind of what he always wanted to do anyways.
Yeah, like, is it?
That's why he left in 1980. Part of it was that he really wanted to give this whole movies thing a shot. Like, he always thought in the early 70s he'd be directing movies or producing movies. And, I mean, it just didn't really work out for him in the early 80s. And that was part of the reason he came back. The other part of the reason was, and I think Tom Hanks says this, the first time Tom Hanks hosts, he asked Lorne Michaels, why'd you come back? And Lorne Michaels just said, I missed it. But it was also part of, he was kind of a failure in the early 80s. And he was in some financial trouble, I believe, when he came back. But he did want to be a producer on movies, and he wanted to, you know, he wanted to direct. And I think he sort of started to realize that maybe SNL is the thing he should be doing. And that's the thing, like, he's good at, you know?
Yeah. And it seems like critics and viewers would agree with that. Yeah.
Although he, like, co-wrote Three Amigos or produced Three Amigos, so I'm fine with that.
Season 19, next one, we get Norm, Jay Moore, and Sarah Silverman.
Okay.
Good additions, in your opinion?
I don't remember seeing Jay Moore or Sarah Silverman in any sketch, so, yeah. I mean...
Most people just don't realize or remember or choose not to remember Sarah Silverman was ever involved with SNL.
That's fine. I mean, Ben Stiller was on SNL and nobody remembers that either.
Yeah, for like part of one season.
Yeah. Nobody remembers Robbie Downey Jr. was on SNL.
Yeah. That's true too. But yeah, it's just kind of one of those institutions where people go through, whether it's a writer or an actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some people have success and some don't.
Yeah. In that same year where those three came, Phil Hartman left.
Yes. After like 8 years.
Yeah. And not just the length of time he was there, but he was one of those ones that was appreciated pretty well, right?
Yeah, and again, he had sort of that Dan Aykroyd, Gilda Radner thing that everybody seemed to like them, and that he would really sell a sketch that a new writer was writing that you could tell they were really passionate about. And I think Conan O'Brien, who wrote for SNL at the time, says that in read-through, you'd sort of, if Phil Hartman was really giving it his all on a sketch, you'd hear people would just start saying glue, 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 glue. Like, he was the glue. Like, he would sell it all, or he'd pull everything together. Just like, if it's a mediocre sketch, Phil Hartman could make it work, you know? Like,
yeah.
And because he was very talented, and people would always have to explain to Phil Hartman, they're not saying boo, they're saying glue.
Yeah, I read that it was a name that Adam Sandler gave him, and they, I guess when he left, they gave him a little like glue trophy or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like a really widely known nickname for people among the show. And as you said, yeah, he could hold a sketch together really well, but it was also kind of backstage. He was kind of a neutralizing force.
And, yeah, always seemed like a super nice guy as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a show. It's, you know, really quickly paced, high stress. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of tension there. But they said he was really good at diffusing that. And if someone was new to the show, bringing them in and, you know, people who weren't getting along, he was a kind of a good mediator.
Yeah.
Yeah, which just makes everything that happened way more tragic.
Yes.
But anyway, season 20 was another kind of recognized as a weak season. As far as I was reading, pretty much everyone says 6, 11, and 20 are the, like, the weak links in the show.
Okay.
Do you remember the season at all?
No. No. Like, okay. I never watched the SNL till post-2000.
Okay. So this is when Norm got Update.
Okay.
And that's kind of what the only thing people have to say good about that season.
Yeah,
you like Norm's Update, obviously.
I love Norm, so yes.
Okay.
I like when he is in front of a camera telling jokes.
Okay. But yeah, everyone said, I mean, he's known for his OJ jokes, which we can get to in a little bit.
Yep.
But they said the whole season was basically half the jokes were just OJ jokes. The whole plots of certain sketches would be really thin. And I mean, SNL, they're usually pretty thin.
Yeah, yeah.
But even more than usual that was a problem for this season as well.
Yeah.
21, so season 21, they were almost canceled again and kind of did a big overhaul. Again, Lorne Michaels has been there for the whole time, but he felt things really weren't working, so they did an entire overhaul. And this was the year that we had the Rage Against the Machine incident.
That was sort of, like, the overhaul wasn't necessarily Lorne Michaels wanting to do it. A lot of it was very network-forced. Like, Adam Sandler, the executives didn't really care for Adam Sandler, so they're like, get off the show, like, and they wanted Farley off as well, and the Norm thing, and they didn't want him on Update anymore. Yeah, so I don't know that Lorne Michaels really wanted Farley and Sandler to go, partially because they were probably good for ratings, you know?
Yeah.
And, but yeah, they were sort of forced out, and I mean, didn't hurt either of them. Like, they were well on their way to movie careers anyway. Mm-hmm. Although it's debatable that it did hurt Farley, and that, you know, people have said that the only thing that would stop Farley from doing drugs is having somebody you really love taken away from him, and he didn't like it, or he didn't love anything more than he loved SNL. So once, you know, if someone would take a movie offer away from him, there was always another movie offer, but there's only one SNL. So, like, you know, you just didn't have that sort of force to get him back in rehab. But
Do you want to talk about the Rage Against the Machine incident?
I haven't read anything about it in a long time. Who was hosting? Forbes?
Yeah, Steve Forbes, ex-Republican presidential candidate and current billionaire.
Mm-hmm. And Rage Against the Machine was the musical guest, and it would have been around Evil Empire time. So they did, sort of, when their performance started, they sort of hung American flags upside down over their speakers as they started doing Bulls on Parade. And SNL stagehands, like, instantly ran and grabbed them, ripped them off, and the song sort of just went on. And and then they were sort of essentially pulled from the show. They didn't get to do their second song. They didn't get to do the goodbyes. And they were essentially censored, but I feel like NBC has the right to do that.
Yeah, it's, you're right. They just hung the flags upside down. They stopped it really quickly. I guess Tom Morello shredded one of the flags and busted into Steve Forbes' change room and threw it at him and started yelling at him.
Okay.
I mean, obviously the issue is this Republican right-wing guy who's very rich, not really coincide with
comedy.
The vague, oh, not that. I think the messages, the messages that Rage Against the Machine likes to put forward, and just the comedy aspect. Absolutely. Someone so rich is just telling jokes while, you know, people are sad and poor and all that.
Yeah.
Typical Rage things.
Yeah.
The next year is the year Phil Hartman and Chris Farley die.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked a bit about Farley's death already. Do you want to talk a bit about Hartman's, or?
Yeah, it's super tragic. His wife killed him and then killed herself. Super sad.
Yep.
You know, I don't really have all that much to say about it.
Okay. Do you know about the John Lovitz, Andy Dick angle of it all?
I know I've read it, like, sort of John Lovitz accuses Andy Dick of giving her drugs or something like that.
Yeah, so this is Phil Hartman's third wife, who was a former model, and she wanted to be an actress and just really wasn't that successful in her career. But coming up, she had drug problems, and she was finally clean and sober, and her career still wasn't taking off, and she was a little bit depressed about it. And I guess the rumor is that Andy Dick offered her cocaine for the first time in a long time, and then that, like, sent her into having a nervous breakdown, which caused her to get in this huge fight with Phil Hartman, which caused her to kill him in his sleep and then kill herself. And then I guess John Lovitz says that, you know, it's all Andy Dick's fault because he sent her back into this kind of downward drug spiral. And Andy Dick obviously denies it, so it's kind of a whoever you want to believe.
Yeah.
And more people believe John Lovitz because, well, he's not Andy Dick.
Yeah. I would believe John Lovitz instead of Andy Dick, but I'm not going to pass judgment on that. I don't know anything about it.
I mean, it's an interesting story. You can look into it if you want. But it's really sad. This is the year that Norm leaves the show.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about, he lost Update the year before and then kind of hung around, and then this year he left. So do you want to talk about his departure?
I thought the thing was, what he says about it is that he found out Farley dies, and then 3 hours later, he finds out that he was being taken off Update, and he didn't really care, you know, because Chris Farley just died.
Oh, okay.
And
why was he taken off Update?
Don Olmeyer, who was an NBC executive, didn't find him funny, didn't find Norm funny, which is mildly interesting because, a couple years later, when the job was up, or earlier when the job was up for grabs, Olmeyer didn't want Al Franken, an old writer from the 70s who still wrote for the show then, came back with Lorne Michaels, wanted Update. He really wanted Update and was between Franken and Norm. And Olmeyer didn't want to sort of have this face from the old show be sort of a centerpiece of the show. So he just wanted to make sure Franken didn't get it. Franken didn't get it. Franken left the show. And so Norm got it basically because Olmeyer wanted him to, and then Olmeyer was like, yeah, I don't find him funny. And there were a lot of OJ jokes, like you pointed out, and Olmeyer was a friend of OJ and publicly stood up for OJ when the OJ thing was happening. And, you know, whatever. network interference again. And
yeah. Actually, that's funny. I forgot to mention, did you hear about Al Franken almost being executive producer and showrunner too?
Yeah, yeah. In the, like, 79-80 season, Lorne Michaels was pushing for, you know, somebody like Tom Shaler or Al Franken, like a writer, to become the new producer of the show. And Michaels was reportedly really pushing for Franken. And towards the end of the show's run, Franken did a piece on Update that was called Limo for Lamo. And I forget the name of the guy that he was attacking, but it was sort of like an NBC executive that... It's like, why does this guy get a limo when he doesn't really do anything? Or, like, send all these letters to this guy so that I can get to use his limo. And nobody told this executive that this thing was coming, even though it ended up being super harsh. And he got a lot of mail about it. So that sort of, like, sealed Franken's fate as far as getting that producer job. So
yeah. So that was the end of Norm, sadly.
Well, he just got fired from Update. He still had stick around and do sketches, which he wasn't particularly thrilled about because he didn't like doing sketches.
Yeah, he liked Update the most, right?
Yeah, that's all he liked.
Yeah, so he hung around to the end of the season and then kind of just left.
Yeah.
He came back to host later and does a great monologue about being not funny enough to be in the building and now being funny enough to host the show.
Yeah.
I love that monologue. Yeah. So the next season, 24, we get Jimmy Fallon and Horatio Sanz.
What?
Is that Horatio Woo?
I hate Horatio Woo.
Because he's the new Farley?
No, it's because he's not funny. That's why I hate him.
Okay, well, I saw a lot of people saying that Jimmy Fallon and Horatio Sanz were just clearly their attempt at replacing Adam Sandler and Chris Farley.
Yeah, I see that 100%.
I never really realized how similar they were.
Well, and people, Lorne Michaels always talks about people like, when they come into the show now, he's sort of like, well, you've got this role. I see you doing what Murray did or something like that, you know, and he will say this to people that are cast members on the show. He's very much, like sort of casting from his back catalog type of thing, you know,
yeah.
He's looking for types of people, you know, cause he knows what works and it's those types of people. Yeah. So it's very much that type of thing. Like I'm sure Tina Fey was sort of a Jane Curtin type, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, I guess I forgot about Jimmy Fallon and Adam Sandler both doing their musical things on Weekend Update. And
both being very goofy.
Yeah.
And very childlike.
Yes, absolutely. This is also when we get Parnes.
Yes.
Chris Parnell.
Yeah.
What up, Parnes?
Yeah.
Then the year after that was their 25th anniversary.
Yes. Which is a wicked show. There's like this 3-hour primetime special celebrating SNL's 25th anniversary. I watched it a bunch of times. It's super entertaining. And yeah, it's really interesting to see all of the people that were involved in SNL, with the exception of Eddie Murphy, back sort of in one room. And
why is he not there?
There are a lot of sort of theories. One is that he doesn't like that the show sort of badmouths him, which is something I completely get because the show absolutely gets canceled even before Lorne Michaels comes back. The show gets canceled in the 80s without Eddie Murphy. There's not even a question about that.
And how do they badmouth him? Just making jokes about his career?
Just
now.
Making jokes about his career. There was a David Spade Hollywood Minute joke that he didn't care for. And there was something even earlier on, like when Lorne Michaels first came back, and it was just sort of like, nah, I don't like this, you know?
Yeah.
Like in the late, like 87, something around there. Yeah. So he just doesn't like, he still cares about the show. It's like, you know, Chris Rock has sort of said that, Eddie Murphy still cares about the show. He just doesn't want to be involved with it anymore. Like he's happy he did his time there and he's very proud of it. But, you know, doesn't like the way he's referred to on the show. And I don't know, it's sort of, he thinks that he saved the show. And I think he's 100% correct. And can't take a joke, that's fine. But, you know, I think he's got valid reasons to not take a joke, I suppose.
Yeah, considering he clearly saved that show.
Yeah, if there's anybody that shouldn't be allowed to, you know, have shots taken on them on, you know, SNL, it's like the dead SNL stars and Eddie Murphy.
Okay. So, I mean, that brings us to 2000.
All right. That's the end of part one. So be sure to check back next week for part two of our discussion of Saturday Night Live. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.